This is John Rappaport. This is a big one, folks. This is the parallels, mirror images between AIDS and COVID. And the reason that I'm doing this is because I wrote the book AIDS, Inc. in 1988. I plowed through a tremendous amount of material to get to the bottom line of the fraud that was AIDS. And as soon as I saw COVID breaking all these years later, I knew it was the same pattern in about 5 minutes. There was nothing any different. The only difference, I'll get into that, of course, was the lockdowns and the messaging. But it was the same pattern. And other epidemics that have been duds that I've covered over the years, like swine flu of 2009, West Nile, SARS 2003, Zika, Ebola, they all follow the same basic pattern. Scientifically, the hoax is basically the same. The structure of the hoax is basically the same. So one of the major big heroes is a man that I call Ellis Medavoy, whom I interview over the course of many, 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 many pages in my collection, The Matrix Revealed. That's a pseudonym for a man that I met many, many years ago, who was, in fact, a retired insider propaganda master, I would have to say, who worked for what we would now call globalist elites, doing the deepest kind of propaganda and propaganda research that I've ever run across. And in those interviews, you would see how deep he actually goes. And some of the things that he told me all these years ago prepared me for the medical and scientific research that I did on both AIDS and COVID. And one of the things that he said to me was, you're looking for a construction. He said, you're always going to find it. It's a system. It has moving parts and they connect to each other. You're not going to see all the moving parts at the same time. You're going to dig them out of the earth, so to speak, one at a time. You're going to focus on each one at a time, and then gradually you're going to see how they're all connected. That's the construction. That's the structure that's being imposed. The scientific structure, the medical structure, whatever the narrative, as we would say now, it is, he said to me, this is what you're going to find. And you're going to think at different times that you've gotten the whole structure in view and you won't be seeing the whole structure. And he and I went back and forth on this in great depth. And he kept stressing it over and over again. You're going to think that you see the whole structure. You're not seeing it yet. Keep digging for the parts. Keep reviewing what you've already discovered, because certain things you consider to be pedestrian and minor are going to be major when you relook at them again. They are key parts of the structure. The planners, he said, know the structure from the beginning. They do not appear in public. They are not promoting anything. They are not the front men. They are not even the Bill Gateses and the Klaus Schwabs of the World Economic Forum. They are none of those people. He said, you're not going to see the real planners. And he even spoke about conferences and so forth. He said, yes, if you look at some of these pre-planning exercises, you're going to see certain elements that are provocative. But these are not the guys that are doing the real planning, who are creating the complete structure. This is not what it is. You've got to keep going and keep looking. Because the planners know how all the parts connect. They know how everything meshes and adds up to be an imposing story, narrative, scientific research project, startlingly new pandemic, etc., etc., etc. Don't look to the World Health Organization or the CDC, he said, for the ultimate plan and structure or the planners. You're not going to find them there. Everybody that's talking to you and everybody else out there in public, they are the public relations propaganda people, including the scientists, who many of whom are true believers in what they're doing. So once I was impressed, to say the least, with all that, I could begin digging into the swamp and morass that was AIDS in 1987 and start to dig up these pieces of the puzzle, which would be, again, complete parallels, mirror images of COVID. And when I started writing about COVID in the winter of 2020, several colleagues of mine said, well, how do you know this all of a sudden? And I said, because I've done it before, because it's the same pattern. It's the same structure as AIDS. That's how I know. I can see the rollout. I can see the same apartment building, you might say. It's got the same apartments. It's got the same manager. It's got the same janitors. It's got the same cleanup crew. It's got the same rental structure. It's got the same everything. There's nothing any different. There's not going to be anything any different. That's how I know. And so I began rolling out the articles on COVID to intense interest all over the web, because people said, well, yeah, I guess I see what you're saying. I see what you're talking about here. I see what you're talking about there. What else? And so I began to tell them what else. I began to predict what else, how it was going to work, what the elements of the phony pandemic were. And what I had discovered in researching AIDS in 87 and 88 was there really is only one structure for these pandemics. There really is only one kind of apartment building that you can build in order to foist off this kind of insanity on everybody. It's predetermined by what you, the effect that you want to produce. And so, although I've mentioned this before, I want to just go through it once more about my research in 1987-88. One aspect of that, which was I was in the middle of the swamp immediately. I was looking around for something I could hold on to and hook on to, because I didn't know, because I didn't know where to go, where to start. I knew intuitively there had to be something fraudulent about all of this. It was instinct more than anything else, because I had done some research before on killer drugs, medical drugs. I knew something about the companies that produced them, the mindset of these people, and so on and so forth. But in 87, I was fishing around in the dark with AIDS and HIV. And in my little room in West Los Angeles, I had these notes that I was making taped to the wall all over my room, and the notes were expanding every day. There were questions, there were quotes, there were statements, there were possible conclusions. There was no internet, there was no email, there was no anything. There was the phone. There was the U.S. Postal Service. There were audio cassettes. That's what you had in those days. So one of the first things that I did was I fished around with friends and colleagues and so forth, asking them, do you know anybody who thinks that AIDS is different from the picture that we're being given in the press? And I got a couple of answers, and I contacted Robert Strecker, MD, out in Eagle Rock, California. And as I've mentioned before, he said to me, yes, this is a virus that was put together. It's a combination of animal viruses, cow and sheep. It's basically a kind of a bioweapon. You could look at it as an accident or intention, but that's what happened. Okay. So that was the first inkling that I had, if you want to call it an inkling, that something was amiss. And one of the reasons that I bring up Bob Strecker, who was a friend of mine, passed away, is because he and I ultimately parted ways because we came up with completely different conclusions about HIV. But, and this I consider very important, I never considered him an opponent or an enemy or a disinformationist or any of that sort of thing. And in the little preface or foreword to AIDS Inc., my book in 88, I basically wrote that a significant amount of my research was done by interviewing various scientists, taking snapshots of what they said, and putting a major collage together. And that these different researchers were, as I put it, taking different trains to different destinations. They did not know about each other particularly, nor did I talk to them about these other sources that I was consulting. And I never considered any of these sources to be opponents or enemies, aside from several researchers in the heart of the National Institutes of Health, like Fauci, like Robert Gallo, and so forth. But aside from that, no. I've never taken that view. My MO has been to get good information from where I can get it, wherever that is, and to put together my own picture, and not to start little petty squabbles and battles and wars with people who disagree with me, people who may be doing excellent work in the area, in what I would consider, let's say, one aspect of that area, such as vaccines, with whom I would agree on that particular issue, but disagree on many other things. I have no interest whatsoever in starting these ground wars. That's bullshit for me as a researcher. I want to get information. That's how I put together AIDS Inc. Robert Strecker was the first man who opened my eyes to the possibility that the narrative we were being fed by the government and the press about AIDS was completely wrong. He did a tremendous service for me, even though I ended up completely disagreeing with the picture that he was painting. Okay. So, here I was in the dark, in the swamp, with AIDS, trying to find something to grab onto, something I could use as leverage. And where did it begin? What was the first thing that I found? Well, the first thing that I found was different people had different interpretations of what HIV was. Strecker had his. A key moment came when I found Chuck Ortleb, another hero, who was the publisher of a biweekly paper in New York, a little tiny paper called the New York Native, who was publishing articles by a couple of Boston scientists who were saying there was a good chance that AIDS was caused by a different virus, African swine fever. Okay, I grabbed onto that. I looked into that research. It seemed to have some merit. One of the researchers, Jane Tees, had been to Africa. She had seen the spread, according to her, of African swine fever. Well, Africa was one of those places where, of course, people were saying HIV was running rampant. So I continued to read the New York Native, and then all of a sudden, as I was looking for, is HIV really made up of other viruses? Is it another virus that's causing AIDS? All of this, I'm grabbing these different handholds, trying to see what's going on. You've got to sort of put yourself in my position in the dark. You know, what do I know? In 87. And all of a sudden, in the, I guess, the summer, early summer of 87 or the spring, late spring, the New York Native runs a piece about molecular biologist Peter Duesberg at University of California at Berkeley, who has just written a paper, March 1987, in the journal Cancer Research about HIV. And Duesberg is a major mainstream researcher, cancer researcher. He's got grants, he's got funding, he's got reputation, he's got status, he's worked at National Institutes of Health alongside Robert Gallo and other virologists. And in this dense, complex scientific paper in the journal Cancer Research, March 1, 87, he's saying that HIV is a terrible candidate to assume is the cause of AIDS. Even though 3 years ago, 84, it's been announced officially by the U.S. government as the cause of AIDS. And he explains why. And I can grasp some of the details in his paper, as well as from the New York Native. And he's saying that this virus is supposed to be destroying the immune system, which is the hallmark of AIDS, according to the research, by infecting T cells, which are major component of the immune system. But he's saying The research really shows that HIV is only infecting a tiny, tiny number of these T cells, and there are gigantic numbers of T cells in the body, and they reproduce often and naturally in the body, and therefore there would be no possible way that HIV could cause the collapse of the immune system by infecting T cells. To me, that's the major takeaway. There are others. The second big takeaway is, Duesberg says, look, HIV is a retrovirus. I have studied retroviruses extensively as part of the viral cancer project at National Institutes of Health, where we were all looking for viruses, retroviruses, that could cause cancer. And that was a dead end. And I quit. Well, now we have a political storm because others did not quit, most notably Robert Gallo, who continued to bloviate and claim that indeed he did find two retroviruses. Again, that's a particular specific class of virus that caused leukemia, cancer. Duesberg says nonsense. Never happened. No proof whatsoever. And in fact, what we see about retroviruses is they, and he was very colorful in his language and imagery, Duesberg was, they just lie around doing nothing, basically. They're one of those types of viruses that do nothing. They just kind of sit there, lie there, and that's it. And the whole proposition, Duesberg said, that they are sleeper viruses, that they stay there and stay there, and then they are suddenly activated, and now they become deadly, is absolute nonsense. There is no proof for that. There is just supposition, assumption, speculation. There is no evidence that that is the case. That's the second blockbuster that he unleashed. And in the process of unleashing both of those blockbusters, he was completely blacklisted from mainstream science. I've gone into that in the past. I won't try to recap all of that. But his mainstream reputation was destroyed on purpose and with intent, with a hurricane of howling from mainstream virology and science, in medical journals, in gossip, in every way, in press articles, because he had made himself dangerous and an enemy. And strangely, I have to say, strangely, for a mainstream famous scientist, he didn't care. He was willing to take the blows. That's a hero. So now I was armed with this proposition. HIV is not the cause of AIDS. I spoke with Chuck Ortlieb. We went back and forth on this. I spoke with other people. Virologists. I've told this before, but it's very important because it was a key moment for me. I spoke with a major virologist at UCLA on the telephone one day. And I said to him, you know, there is a controversy about HIV as the cause of AIDS. And he said to me, yes, I'm aware of that. And then he said, we can see that there are political stakes in this game. And we're taking a pass on the whole question. I said, really? He said, yes. Taking a pass. I mean, you know, this has been announced. Come on. As a violent epidemic that is possibly going to destroy civilization as we know it, is going to make people go into complete fear and panic about sex, procreation, is going to polarize society, gay, anti-gay, etc., to all of that. I mean, the ripples and the repercussions don't end. And here's this well-known virologist saying to me, we're going to take a pass on the scientific question of whether HIV causes AIDS. He's completely aware that this is a real question that does not have a pat answer. And reading between the lines of what he's saying, it's clear to me that what he's really saying is he sees Duesberg's arguments and they are valid, but he doesn't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole. Now I feel weaponized. This now is a war I understand. It's a political war that involves scientific issues, medical issues. This has been an instinct of mine for God knows how long up to that point. I don't know exactly where it came from, but you could call it a brewing suspicion. You could call it all kinds of things. But one of the ways in which, in the brief 5 years of my career up to that point as a journalist, one of the ways in which I saw myself as separate from other journalists, including alternative journalists, was that I had this magnetic pull toward medical issues, that I considered them political, that they were very deep, that they were very important, that other journalists were completely uneducated and ignorant about them and were ignoring them and did not factor them into the political wars that were shaping culture, civilization, our future. And I still maintain that to a significant degree as a position now, because I see all manner of journalists, some of whom are quite intelligent, that just refuse to wade into the pool of the medical and to see what it really is, and still try to argue politics, which to me is futile. You just can't get into the deepest area of politics unless you become thoroughly acquainted with medical fakery. So I felt weaponized, and then I found more so-called mainstream biologists at Harvard, others at UC Berkeley, who were arguing basically what Duesberg was arguing, and very convincingly, that there was no reason to suppose that HIV was the cause of AIDS. That was the first major handhold that I grabbed onto in the dark. That now began to unearth other pieces of what Medavoy told me would be the construction, the structure, the apartment building. That was number one. Now, of course, many of you are familiar with the fact that here in 2022, you know, I've been saying now for years that viruses are not being discovered at all, you know, that they don't exist. That came much, much, much later. There was no inkling for me at the time that this was even a question to consider. I was riding the horse of HIV is not the cause of AIDS. HIV is real, but it is not the cause of AIDS. Okay. So now I began to take a look at all of the notes that I had gathered and pasted to my wall. Things were now realigning and rearranging themselves like counters going click, 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 click. And the first new piece of the construction that I saw was the umbrella label itself called AIDS, A-I-D-S, Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. This was big. I asked myself the question, well, if HIV does not cause AIDS, then what is AIDS? What does that mean? Because, and here, screw your brain in real tight to get this one. If mainstream researchers are saying that Africans, gay men in New York, San Francisco, LA, hemophiliacs, transfusion blood recipients, Haitians, are all suffering from the same syndrome called AIDS, and that, and the proof of that is that they are all these groups linked together by the virus called HIV, which is the cause of AIDS, but HIV is not the cause of AIDS, then what do we have? Should we really consider these different groups of people all over the world as connected at all? Is AIDS, the word, actually a label for anything? Or is it brilliant, pure deception? It's all in a name. You give something a name, and that something, whatever it is or isn't, suddenly becomes a thing in people's minds. Very potent indeed, very powerful. So my next question was, well, is there something else that links all of these groups of people all over the world if it's not HIV? And what would that be? If we're going to say that they are all suffering from the same syndrome. And I looked and looked and looked. And the only thing that I could find, the only thing was collapse of the immune system. That was the only thing that could be linking Haitians, blood transfusion recipients, hemophiliacs, gay men, Africans, together. That was the purported hallmark of AIDS, immune system collapse. In which case, the person can be infected by any bug coming down the pipeline, any toxic substance, whatever, because they have no immune defense left. And these little infections in other people become gigantic infections in them, and then they die, and okay? So that was the only connection among all of these groups. But what kind of connection really is that? Because collapse of the immune system is not something, as I could immediately perceive, that is very specific. It's not like, you know, somebody's eyeballs fall out. It's not like they have heart attacks. It's not like they all have brain aneurysms. Immune system collapse is a very general term. So let me start to look into that. I'm building the construct piece by piece. And I go to the Biomed Library, because there's no such thing as online at UCLA. And I begin to work with the reference librarian, and she educates me on how to look for citations in medical journals. And I begin handwriting in a big notebook these titles of studies that seem to be relevant, you know, immune system, immunodeficiency, immune system deficiency, et cetera, et cetera. And I take an elevator down to the basement of the Biomed Library, where there are volumes of old medical journals, and I begin to uncover immune system collapse as the mainstream medical establishment has researched it. And of course, I begin to discover multiple factors, that any one of which could cause immune system collapse. As you would know, you know, without even doing that. For example, gross pollution. If you've got chemicals from a factory running into the groundwater, you know, all of those kinds of things. But then I came across the following gem in several studies. The depletion of T cells, again, key cells of the immune system. The greatest cause of T cell depletion in the world is severe malnutrition. Boom, bang, pow, bam. There you go. Okay. Severe malnutrition, Africa, Haiti. Anybody eating mainly a junk food diet, that's going to take in all kinds of these people from these five groups that are supposedly the high risk groups that the CDC has listed at great risk for AIDS. Severe malnutrition. Well, in Africa, you can take that much further. Protein calorie malnutrition, hunger, starvation, you know, and everything that goes with that, wasting away. Intense diarrhea, etc., etc. Okay, building the construct. And gradually, piece by piece, I begin to put together the causes, multiple causes, of immune system collapse in each one of these five groups. They are not the same. They are not identical from group to group. And even within a group, you would ultimately have to get down to the individual to see what is suppressing his or her immune system specifically. But there are certain generalizations you can make about these groups or subgroups within the groups. And they are not the same from group to group. For example, and this I discovered through interviews. If you were to look at the gay bathhouse scene in New York and San Francisco, for example, you would see the rampant use of recreational drugs, street drugs, which are immune suppressing in and of themselves, as well as having marathon sex with many partners would be immune suppressing as well over time, leading to adrenal exhaustion, sexually transmitted diseases, etc., etc., etc. I mean, I could spell it out in great detail, but it's quite obvious. And one man whom I interviewed, who was quite knowledgeable about San Francisco, just said, you know, people, men in these bathhouse scenes, some of these men were just dropping like flies. They were dying. There were people inside the bathhouses selling the drugs. It was part of the scene. Factor 8, which was the most recent form of injection for hemophiliacs, turned out to be itself immunosuppressive. Another example. So piece by piece, I began putting all of this together. Now it wasn't dark anymore. Now there was a lot of sunlight shining. Now I was beginning to see the pattern and the construct emerging. Pretend that a virus is what links together all the people you say are the victims of a syndrome or a disease. Lie about that virus as the cause. Claim the virus is causing a condition that is, in fact, widespread among many groups, a generalized condition, which in this case is immune system collapse. Say falsely that the virus is doing that to the immune system when it isn't. And then you have a story to tell about a viral epidemic. When in fact, when you split it all up and study each group separately, you find the actual reasons for the immune suppression in each group. And none of that has anything to do with HIV. That's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night, energized to the hilt, if you're a journalist. You're catching on. You're seeing this now. You're seeing this now. There we go. There it is. Now we're talking. The word AIDS is really just a deceptive label. An umbrella label that is linking together various groups of people who are in fact suffering from different items, none of which is the virus you claim is at the bottom of the syndrome. Okay. Next up in building the construct, but wait, there's a test for HIV. Think about that. Okay. This is the thing that's going to allow the doctors to say to their patients, you're infected. You either have AIDS or pre-AIDS. If you have pre-AIDS, it's inevitably going to develop into AIDS. And it's lethal. There's a test. I'm going to give you the test. What could be more potent, life-changing, and hypnotic than that? Now, at that time, the test was an antibody blood test that would register either positive or negative for the presence of HIV. And this was a gigantic story that needed to be untangled in itself because it was very confusing. And it took me a while to figure this one out. So let's see how to begin here. First of all, if a patient tested positive, the doctor would say, you're positive for HIV. So you have it in your body. And depending on your symptoms, which I can assess, you either have AIDS now or you're going to get AIDS. Okay? That's number one. However, as Peter Duisberg and others pointed out, this was a reversal of the traditional interpretation of antibody tests up to that point in time. Because in many cases, if a person tested positive for antibodies to a virus, the doctor would say, well, this shows that your immune system reacted against the virus when you contacted it, because antibodies are the scouts of the immune system. They identify viruses that the immune system is supposed to attack and neutralize. So this is a good thing. It shows, most probably, that you have gained immunity to that virus. But no, now all of that was turned on its head and reversed to say, if you test positive for antibodies to HIV, it means AIDS. That's your destiny. It doesn't mean that your immune system has overcome or neutralized HIV. So even though I now know that HIV does not cause AIDS, I have to look into this blood test because it is the weapon that's being used to pull people into the diagnosis of AIDS. And here we go with the next piece of the construct. It is also the test that is being used to add up the number of cases of so-called AIDS all over the world. Sound familiar? And newspapers are reporting what the CDC and the World Health Organization are saying every day about the number of cases, the number of HIV positive people, and the number of people that have been diagnosed with full-blown AIDS, all based essentially on the blood test, the antibody test. Okay, so even though I know that fundamentally the antibody test is testing for the wrong thing and it's totally irrelevant, I want to look into this test further. And I do. I definitely do. And this teaches me something that I will use later with COVID, which is look at the diagnostic test. Keep looking at it. Keep investigating it. Keep exploring it. Don't back away from it. Don't assume that it is a good test or a useful test or a reliable test or a relevant test. Back to the UCLA Biomed Library. Now I'm going down to the basement and looking at old medical studies on antibody tests. Antibody tests not just for HIV, but antibody tests in general for any kind of virus. Going back in time. And shockingly, and I lay this out in my book, Chapter and Verse in AIDS, Inc., this is what I find. There are two basic types of antibody tests. One is called the ELISA. The other, the Western blot. The ELISA is the frontline test, and the Western blot is the backup gold standard test to confirm what you find on the ELISA test. So all kinds of people back in the day are saying about the AIDS test, blood test, you know, different things. Well, if you test positive on the ELISA, take another test. If you test positive again, then do the Western blot. If that comes up positive, then you can assume that you're positive for HIV. Now, that configuration is not the only one. There are other types of recommendations, too, and it's confusing and off-putting, to say the least. But, you know, I track all that down. But here's what I discover in the mainstream medical journals. The ELISA blood test is completely unreliable for several reasons. Perhaps the most significant of which is that when it turns up antibodies that it says are specific antibodies to a specific virus, that may not be the case at all. In fact, those antibodies may be showing up on the test because they are cross-reacting, that's the term, with factors in the body that have nothing to do with that particular virus that is being tested for. The person drank alcohol the night before. The person is eating junk food. The person had a particular vaccine. On and on and on and on. So therefore, we must go to the Western blot test, which is another antibody test that is much more reliable. But lo and behold, as I keep on wearing out my eyes, reading medical studies, I discover that's not true either. That there are studies that show that the Western blot test is not really the gold standard. It too has the same fallacies that the ELISA test has. And there are other problems with both of these tests that render them unreliable. And they are detailed, those problems, in these mainstream medical studies, if you look far enough. So I decided, well, I should talk with a few current AIDS researchers. And as I've mentioned in other podcasts, at that time in 1987-88, that was possible. I, an unknown journalist, could actually get on the phone and call up Harvard or the National Institutes of Health or the CDC and wangle my way into a phone conversation with an actual well-known researcher, which I did on one or two occasions, more than that, but in this case with the blood tests. And I spoke to one researcher, and I detail that in the book, and I say, look, this is what I found about ELISA and Western blot. And he says, yes, there can be problems, so forth. But by and large, we believe these tests are good tests. He's shining me on. This is crap. He's covering for an unreliable test on which the fate of many, many people rests. It was apparent in the conversation. He didn't say to me, okay, now look, I'm going to spell out why these two tests really are reliable. Now listen up and make notes. No, he just glossed it all over. And I found other statements from other current researchers in 1987 who were doing the same thing. Well, yes, there can be problems, but by and large, these are very reliable tests. No, they aren't. This is a giant scandal. That's another piece of the construction that I discover. And then later, after my book is published, I believe, We then begin to get into PCR testing for HIV. And that presents its own can of worms, which I'll describe when I get to COVID, because that became, of course, the test of choice for COVID diagnosis. Okay, that's another piece of the construct. Then we come to symptoms. What are the symptoms of AIDS that will make a doctor say, the test shows you're not only HIV positive, but you actually have AIDS? So somewhere there must be a list of symptoms that are unique to AIDS. But it turns out, of course, that's not true. Because in my book, I publish the 15-page CDC surveillance definition of AIDS. And to try to boil it down, what I discover is, since the mainstream view is that people whose immune systems are destroyed by HIV are then prone to any kind of, say, bacterial infection, infection from any germ, then the symptoms of those infections, which could be, say, cough, fever, fatigue, muscle ache, pain, headache, lung congestion, et cetera, et cetera, those would now be exported into the symptoms of AIDS. And therefore, if a person walks into a doctor's office with what we could call common flu-like illness and tests positive for HIV, he could easily be told by the doctor, you have full-blown AIDS. Another piece of the construct, the vague list of symptoms that go on and on and on that people wrongly assume are unique, must be unique to AIDS or COVID or whatever it is. Wrong, 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 wrong. And this, of course, is on purpose as well, because if you want to inflate case numbers and you want to inflate fear and danger and treatment, you concoct a scenario whereby all manner of symptoms can be used to result in a diagnosis of whatever the thing is you're diagnosing, AIDS, COVID, whatever it is. That's what you do. And that has been done with one so-called epidemic after another. And I've gone into detail in my articles on all of these fake epidemics. You just simply expand the list of symptoms. And nobody questions that. You need promoters and PR people who are actually scientists like Fauci to do this, to say, well, the data show, we know from emerging studies and all of these kinds of pat phrases that convince the brainwashed public that this is science, that these symptoms are somehow relatable, unique to COVID or AIDS or whatever it is, when in fact that's not true at all. That's big, that's huge, that's gigantic. That's something that I found out and understood completely in 1987, 88. That's another piece of the construct. Okay. Now we come to the toxic treatment, because, of course, all of this leads in AIDS to, now we have to treat you. We're working on a vaccine, but we must have drugs. And here it gets really sinister, sadistic, Orwellian, and monstrous, because the researchers and their parrots in the press are basically saying, look, we know that this virus, HIV, which causes AIDS, is lethal. It kills you. Therefore, we're in desperate straits. So whatever drug or drugs we come up with to try to kill the virus are justified. No matter how toxic the drugs are, no matter how dangerous they are, because the patient is in a life or death struggle, and therefore we have to take a moonshot, and try to reverse the illness with treatment with these toxic drugs. And before I get specific on that, I have to back up and say, meanwhile, in 87, I am interviewing people who have been diagnosed as HIV positive, which means lethality, progression to full-blown AIDS, death. And they are telling me, bullshit, I rejected the diagnosis, I rejected HIV, I stayed healthy, nothing happened to me, I didn't take the drugs. Or, yes, I had health problems when I was diagnosed with HIV and AIDS, but instead of paying attention to the diagnosis or taking the drugs, I worked with a natural practitioner, or I worked with myself, and I rebuilt my health. I stopped doing the things that were destroying my health, and instead I started doing healthy things, and I put my faith in that program, and it succeeded. I was not a terminal patient. In my interviews with these people and in my reports I was getting of other such people, it was clear to me that, in fact, the whole promotional campaign that AIDS was fatal, lethal, was a hoax. It was being used as fear porn, as pressure to take the test, to accept the diagnosis, to take the drugs. Okay? Now, the frontline first drug, of course, was AZT. And as I've mentioned before, it was a failed chemotherapy drug for cancer that had been put on the shelf years and years before, because it didn't work. And some people said it was put on the shelf because it was too toxic. What I found in my research was it was put on the shelf because it didn't work. But all chemotherapy is incredibly toxic. That's the way it works. The premise is we try to kill the cancer and hope we don't kill the patient before we kill the cancer. So all of a sudden, for reasons beyond any sense whatsoever, having been tested on rats and then shelved as a drug, AZT was taken off the shelf, and it was announced that a study would be rushed into existence with volunteers, human volunteers, and journalist John Lauritsen, who recently passed away, covered that groundbreaking study, which led to the licensing by the FDA, the approval of the drug, in his book, Poison by Prescription, the AZT Story, and in articles that he wrote, as a completely incompetent, failed, useless study in which the results were interpreted to mean the drug was successful and therefore it was put on the market when it was actually a killer drug. And it was being prescribed, once it was licensed, at very high doses on a daily basis, not as chemotherapy ordinarily is, in short bursts, because even the people who use chemotherapy know that it can kill people and does kill people, and therefore they limit its use. But in the case of ACT, no. Just keep taking high dose ACT on and on and on and on, and you die. You die. You die. Because it attacks all cells of the body, as chemotherapy does, and prevents cells from replicating. That's called murder. And that was the drug. And it was heavily promoted and widely promoted by the National Institutes of Health, Fauci, Robert Gallo, who is the fake discoverer of the cause of AIDS, by everybody, press, government, activist groups who are clamoring for more money for AIDS research. And of course, and here's another piece of the construction. When people prescribed AZT died, of course it was said, well, AIDS killed them, HIV killed them. It wasn't a drug, of course not. We just couldn't get to them soon enough, and therefore their immune system was destroyed by the virus, not the drug, and they died. And in future incarnations of AIDS drugs that were similarly built of similar constituents, it was the same pattern of destruction of cells, the chemotherapy pattern. And the only thing that differentiated early use of AZT, once it was licensed, from later use was doctors and researchers were forced to admit that the dosage level was, you know, absolutely lethal, and so they lowered and lowered the dose. And so some people survived. And this was called the celebratory effect of the drug. Another piece of the construct. Censorship is the next piece. And this was particularly virulent then, and it is now. So, I confirmed this with several mainstream researchers. I said, true or false? In the spring of 1984, May, when the announcement came from the U.S. government, National Institutes of Health, that the cause of AIDS had been found, HIV, or as it was called then, HTLV-3, when that announcement was made, all of the funding previously that had gone into research into different possible causes of AIDS was basically shut down. And therefore, if a researcher after the announcement wanted to get funded to do any research on AIDS, he had to start with the assumption that the cause, in fact, was HIV. Otherwise, he couldn't get money for research. True or false? And the answer unanimously was true. True. So on the basis of no evidence, in fact, much counter evidence, what you got was censorship of all scientific research that purported to investigate what AIDS was, what caused it, if it wasn't it to begin with, all of that off the table, can't get money. And if as a researcher you persist in saying that this kind of outside the lines research should proceed, you were blacklisted. You were cut off. Not just in funding, but cut off in every way possible from the so-called community of researchers. You couldn't publish in recognized journals. You couldn't speak at conferences. In the case of Duisberg, I mean, he just endured everything. His lab was shut down, reduced to a tiny closet at UC Berkeley. I mean, the gossip circuit was loud and long. Every way that you could be censored as a scientist, you were. Period. And if you were a mainstream reporter, you certainly could not publish articles in the mainstream questioning the cause of AIDS in any serious way. Absolutely verboten. And if you were such a journalist, of which there are very, very few, I'm talking now about New York Times, Washington Post, CBS, NBC, you know, the big boys. If you were to go to your editor as a journalist at one of those outlets and, you know, protest and make noise, your reputation could be on the line. If you didn't shut up and toe the line, you could be let go. You could be blacklisted. You could find yourself out in Oshkosh covering Sunday picnics. It was much worse than it is now with COVID because there was no internet. And the alternative outlets, press outlets, were far and few. I managed to get a couple of articles into free weekly papers in the Southern California area. I got an article in Spin Magazine, which was one of the alternative outlets. There may have been a few others. That's it. Period. Censorship. Terms like HIV denialist, AIDS denialist, conspiracy theorist were thrown around and were much more majority rule, I would put it, in those days than now, because, again, the possibilities for a writer, reporter, were so few then. So to be called a conspiracy theorist or AIDS denialist or whatever then was much more significant than, say, now, COVID denialist. Well, I've got blogs, I've got other websites, there's more freedom now, even though there's a lot of censorship, especially on social media. Censorship, that's another piece of the construction. All of these things, you see, that I saw and I built, so to speak, through research then in 87, 88, I knew in 2020 in the winter were going to be the same construction for COVID. There was no doubt about it. You know, it wasn't like, gee, I wonder. No. I could have written the whole script back in January, February of 2020. And I started to do that. I said, here are the elements of a false pandemic. And I would do interviews. How did you know? You know, in retrospect, some of these interviews. Well, how did you know that back in? I said, because AIDS, 1987, 88, it's the same construction. Now, in the aftermath of publishing AIDS, Inc., my book in 88, I eventually discovered, as Ellis Medavoy had told me over and over again, you're not going to see the whole thing until you do. There was a new debate that was surfacing about HIV, which was, does it exist at all? Not just, it's not the cause of AIDS, but it doesn't even exist. That was new. That, as far as I can tell, was pioneered by the Perth group in Australia, a group of scientists headed up by Eleni Papadopoulos. And that's a whole story. I have published excerpts from an interview that Eleni did, she died recently, with an independent journalist, Christine Johnson, in Los Angeles, another hero, a brilliant interview in which Papadopoulos lays out why there is no proof that HIV exists and goes into all of the details about how you discover a virus exists in the lab, what you have to do, and why it was never done, or how it was never done in the case of HIV. Never done. Even though there had been a conference of virologists earlier that had laid out the pattern of how you're supposed to isolate and discover a new virus that everybody had agreed upon, that procedure was not followed in the case of HIV. And the scientists who didn't follow it refused to acknowledge that they didn't follow it, even though it was clear from their published studies that they didn't follow it. And therefore, there was no evidence to suppose that HIV existed at all, at all, at all. And over the years since then, I have read over that interview many times and have spoken about it with other researchers and have clarified points of concern and interest and have come to the conclusion that indeed the Perth group was completely accurate and real, and there was no reason to assume and is no reason to assume that HIV exists. And no reason to assume equals does not exist, because the burden of proof is always on the people who say they have found something new. If they can't show that they found something new, then they could say anything. They could say the cause of AIDS is the purple moon that occurs every 26 days. And if they can't prove that there is such a purple moon, there is no HIV. That's the way it works in science. It's not the strongest point to say there is no reason to assume that it exists. That's not the strongest statement, because I, as the journalist, am not required to submit all possible proofs. You know, that HIV or SARS-CoV-2 exists and then refute each one of them in order to say the virus does not exist, the burden of proof is on the people who claim to have discovered the new virus. And once I saw that about HIV, then I said, okay, now I see the whole construction. This is the construction. And I'll go into the virus does not exist more when I talk about COVID. But here, I want to include just one more piece of the construction, because there is one more piece. And that piece is, getting noise in the background here from gardeners who are not supposed to show up today. I could stop here, but I'm going to continue anyway. I don't want to stop and start. Don't know why these boys are here today. Not supposed to be. Okay. You're just going to have to bear with me. If you want to say that there are particular groups of people or clusters of people around the world during a pandemic that are in fact dying from something that is peculiar to them in a small town, in a city, in a region of a country, and is not just the same as in the larger group of, say, all Italians, for example, but specific groups of people in the north of Italy, you're going to have to get up close and personal with that group of people and find out specifically what is destroying their immune systems or killing them. That's what you're going to have to do. But you can make certain kinds of interpretations that have validity and need further research, such as, for example, in the north of Italy, recent vaccine campaigns that were toxic, that were administered, say, 6 months or a year before the so-called COVID pandemic broke out. And there are other, that's, vaccine campaigns isn't the only thing that you might be looking at. There could be all kinds of things, such as air pollution in a certain area, such as Wuhan, which is obvious when it comes to COVID. Causes pneumonia, which is the keynote of so-called COVID. But you're going to have to get in close and look and find data and see. And at the same time, not blow it up and say, well, now that we've seen the pollution in Wuhan, we know that it's pollution that is really the cause of COVID-19 everywhere in the world. There is no COVID-19. There is just pollution. Not so fast. Don't go crazy with that. You see? And I know there are people who are talking about these odd outlier elements and causes of what is being called COVID or what was called AIDS. And that's how you have to approach those. You have to get in as close as you can to see what's really going on in a specific area or with specific people. That's the other part of the construction. So now we come to COVID. Everything is the same. You've got the risk groups, which is basically the elderly, the people over 50. You've got the umbrella label COVID, which means nothing, just as AIDS means nothing. You've got the no viral explanation for it, because there is no evidence for the virus as being the cause. You've got the vague definition of symptoms. You've got the useless diagnostic test that is completely deceptive, the inflated false case numbers, the toxic treatment, which in this case, of course, includes a killer vaccine. You've got the fear porn, you've got the censorship, and you've got ultimately the virus is not real. And you've also got the toxic drug, in this case remdesivir, and possibly other antivirals. Now with COVID, we've got the PCR test. The PCR test is like the blood test for AIDS in the sense that it's totally unreliable. It misses the boat because who cares if it's the wrong virus they're testing for or there is no virus, then what use is the test that is purportedly testing for a virus? And we have all kinds of internal problems with the test itself, even if we assumed it was testing for the right thing. And I've covered every single one of those in my articles. The two biggest ones with the PCR test for COVID are, number one, the PCR test was devised and built without having an actual sample of the virus there, and it was admitted by the people, Drosten and so forth, who built the PCR test to test for the virus. Built without having a specimen of the actual virus, which means it's all supposition, assumption, presumption, guessing, fabrication, lies, etc. And number two, it's assumed that the PCR test is testing for a piece of RNA that is supposedly from SARS-CoV-2, the virus. But again, that assumption is completely unwarranted because they don't have a specimen of the virus. So if they say we have a piece of it and that's what the test is registering, they're lying. They don't have a piece of it and they never did. But then the case numbers are all based on it. And if you change the sensitivity of the PCR test to make it more or less sensitivity, you can automatically generate larger case numbers or fewer case numbers, because a case is defined as you tested positive for the virus. That's all a case is. So there's that parallel with the test. And I did alert, and I don't know whether this ever got through, DeSantis, governor of Florida, but he did issue a proclamation that laboratories, testing labs in Florida for COVID, would have to report the sensitivity at which they were running the test, which they don't do. They keep that completely private. Because obviously somebody told DeSantis, who knew, hey, the number of cases is going to be completely deceptive and fake to begin with, but it's going to go up or down depending on how the PCR sensitivity is adjusted by the lab. It's fraud. It's outright complete fraud. Just as the AIDS blood test was. And whereas gay men in America and Africans were the two largest groups being targeted with in the AIDS days, and still, with the horrendous drugs, the horrendous treatments, the horrendous fear porn, corralling them in to have their lives destroyed. Now it's the elderly. As I publish these figures over and over again, if you look in every country for the percentage of COVID deaths in people over 50, over 60, over 70, in the nursing homes, in the hospitals, etc., you get a gigantic preponderance of so-called COVID deaths in those places with those elderly people. It is murder of the elderly. It has nothing to do with a virus, as I've spelt out. You terrorize these people into taking the toxic treatments that will kill them. And in some cases, you don't need to even apply the treatments because the diagnosis alone is so terrifying, along with their prior health problems, they will just fold up and die, which has happened by the ton in nursing homes with COVID and happened with gay men and Africans and Haitians with AIDS. Same thing. Same thing. You get somebody in a nursing home now, they have six health conditions, supposedly, that have been current for 10 or 15 years. They're not in good health at all. They have weak immune responses. They've been treated with toxic medications for years and years, further weakening them. And now they're terrified they're going to be diagnosed with COVID-19. They are diagnosed with COVID-19. They're isolated from family and friends, no visitors permitted. They're alone, they're old, they're sick, they are terrified, and they die. Same pattern. In certain third world countries, you will get people who have been excommunicated from their families and their communities because they were diagnosed with HIV. They're already sick because they're hungry. They don't have enough food. They are weak. They are dehydrated. And then they are cut off from their communities completely. They're exiled and they die. Same proposition. The umbrella label is meaningless. There is no AIDS. There is no COVID-19. Those are hypnotic death-dealing labels. With COVID cases, if you look at the symptoms, again, same as AIDS, very vague symptoms. They are basically the symptoms of flu-like illness with COVID. Lung infection, whatever you want to call it. Fatigue, muscle ache, pain, muscle pain, fever. That gets you a diagnosis of full-blown COVID if you test positive. And just as in the days of the 1980s, a gay man who went in to get tested for HIV was more prone to be called positive for HIV than some business executive in Scarsdale going to his doctor. So now, somebody who is elderly in a nursing home is more prone to be called positive for COVID. Risk groups. Political risk groups. Murdered. toxic treatment of remdesivir, highly toxic, destroys cells of the body, keeps cells of the body from replicating, as AZT does. Has the same or similar effect on the body. Now, you could say, okay, the big difference is the vaccine because there's a vaccine for COVID. Yes, certainly true. Over 1,200,000 injuries or from vaccines already reported in the U.S. federal database. The underreporting factor is usually considered to be 100. You multiply the number of injuries by 100 to get the real number. So the number of deaths is just out of control. I mean, I could recount numerous stories, athletes holding up and dying on the playing field, et cetera, et cetera. It's all being covered up. Censorship now. Social media, YouTube, canceling accounts, banning accounts, removing videos. I don't know how many things I've had removed from YouTube. They never tell me. They just take stuff off of YouTube. Because somebody is saying, here's a different body of evidence. You must look at this evidence. And because the symptoms of COVID are so vague in general, as are the symptoms of AIDS, you have a situation where basically anybody can be roped in under that umbrella label and that definition. And the one thing that I've continued to hammer and will hammer forever in any study of an epidemic, a so-called epidemic or pandemic, is the cause of whatever it is never one thing. Never, ever one thing. Therefore, there is no it to begin with. There is no AIDS. There is no COVID. And as I have said over and over, this is the hardest thing for people to accept, to realize, to stay with, to gather, to understand down to the core. Because there is a propensity in humans to want the one thing, the one explanation that covers whatever the territory is supposed to be. I want the one. Give me the it that explains it. But there is no it, and there is no it explanation. There are a group of things happening over a wide area that have been falsely gathered under one umbrella label with a single false cause. And that, to me, if I were to look back on the 1980s, was the biggest light that went on for me. Because it explained so much, in fact, of Rockefeller medicine, the one germ, one disease hypothesis that has been imposed on populations for more than 100 years, the whole branch of fake science called psychiatry, on and on and on. The ripples simply do not end. The use of a term to designate one condition or disease that will then have one cause, even if the cause has not yet been discovered, the researchers will say, well, we know there is a cause, we just haven't found it yet. That's how far they will go in this preposterous hoax. Now let's get to the question of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that doesn't exist. In my discussions and interviews and reading and so forth, and one blockbuster article about Dr. Andrew Kaufman, where he actually took a methods section of a study that claimed to isolate SARS-CoV-2 and went through it piece by piece and showed that every attempt along the way to say, we are isolating, we have isolated this virus and here it is a complete lie and a reversal, of the meaning of isolation to mean non-isolation. In all of that research, it has become even more apparent to me what the strategy of fake discovery of viruses is all about. And it's basically twofold. And the first part of it is, the researchers say, we have a soup that we've made in a dish in the lab. And in this soup, there are monkey cells and human cells. There are antibiotics. There are other chemicals. There is random genetic material. There is a bovine serum. And there is something from a mucus sample of a patient that contains the virus we are looking for. We believe that. Now we observe this soup, undifferentiated glob of soup. And lo and behold, we see that the monkey cells and the human cells are dying. So something is killing them, and the only thing that could be killing them is the virus in the mucus sample from the patient. Therefore, we know that that virus is in the soup and it is doing the killing. So we know we have discovered a new virus and it is killing the cells. Therefore, it is a killer and it is the cause of all these patients who have the same mucus sample all over the world, which is total horseshit from so many angles that even saying it, you know, I could spend 3 hours refuting that. You know? The cells could be dying for many reasons. First of all, they're being starved of nutrients. They're not connected to anything in the human body, so they naturally are going to die. The cells do not continue to exist on their own. Outside the body that they are a part of, the antibiotics could be killing the cells, the other drugs, the chemicals, all sorts of reasons for the death of the monkey cells and the human cells have nothing to do with the supposed virus that's in there. The virus, as you'll notice, has never been actually plucked out of the soup. It's just assumed to continue to be there. So the researchers would have no idea what it looks like or what it is or anything about it. And yet they will say, this is the method by which we have isolated the virus. It's a formula for not isolating a virus. That's number one. And number two, the dome heads who claim that we don't have to isolate the virus because we can discover its genetic sequence without isolating it, and therefore we know what it is, are complete morons or liars, because you can't find out what something is made of if you don't have the thing in front of you to begin with. That should be obvious. If you find a piece of dust in a automobile wrecking yard and the owner points to it and says, "You see, that's from a 1979 Ferrari, and I know that," what is he talking about? And I can analyze the piece of dust and show you that that's the case. Well, go ahead. Let's see it. The only problem is, in the case of the auto wrecking yard, you would have a Ferrari as the gold standard to compare to the piece of dust, you see. Or we sequenced the piece of dust, or whatever you want to say, and we found all these genetic sequences in the piece of dust. And they're the same genetic sequences that we found in the unique bolts of the 1979 Ferrari. Okay. But you see, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, they don't have the Ferrari. They don't have anything. So whatever genetic sequence they come up with, which they claim is the sequence of SARS-CoV-2, is just total fabrication. And you can see that they are actually going into databases of genetic sequences, libraries, and they are picking out pieces, where they are using an AI or program, software program to do that, to just pick pieces out of different sequences and weld them together and smooth out the joints that don't work, and say, this is the sequence of SARS-CoV-2. That's what they mean when they say in silico, meaning in a computer, by a computer, via computer. The in silico construction of the virus or the genetic sequence. So there's nothing there. That's the thing. There's absolutely nothing there. Just as there was nothing there in the antibody blood test for HIV. So I knew that the test was going to be a serious problem with COVID. And because in the interim between AIDS Inc. and 2020, I had realized that HIV doesn't exist at all, I knew that the same issue was going to arise with COVID, because that's the way they discover viruses, by not discovering them. And so people, how does Rabbi Or no, what is he saying? And he's jumping to conclusions. No, I wasn't jumping to any conclusions. I needed to assemble more specific information on how virologists were faking the discovery of COVID, which I did, and that was extremely useful. But I did, and I knew that I would, because it was the same pattern, the same method of non-isolation and discovery as HIV. So So I was equipped in the winter of 2020. I was equipped from the AIDS wars to know what was coming. And that enabled me to say, I don't care what you think. Here's the story. And just as an aside, the readership of No More Fake News blew up immediately and expanded. And even though there were other reporters and other scientists and this and that who would say, no, that's not, couldn't be, the science is good on COVID, and why is he saying that, and he's wrong, and it simply didn't matter to me. Because I had been through it before, and nothing really had changed. And that was the lesson that I learned. The lesson of you do it no matter what. No matter what. And eventually, other people do it. I'm not saying I was the only one who did it. Far from it. David Crow, the late Canadian researcher, a major hero, all the way from the days of AIDS, and I could name many more, Chuck Ortlieb, John Lauritsen, David Rasnick, Celia Farber, Christine Massey now, with her amazing Freedom of Information Act requests that turn back no evidence in our files from, I don't know, it's got to be more than 100 easily now, public health agencies around the world. No records. We have no records of the kind of isolation that you're talking about of SARS-CoV-2. And yes, if you engage those people in a conversation about what they would call isolation and what you would call isolation, there would be differences. Sure, of course. But so what? Your definition of isolation is true and theirs is false. I mean, you just have to stand up for that. You don't say, well, you see, they don't see it that way. Well, of course they don't see it that way, because they have a complete branch of fake science called virology. They're not going to see it that way, ever. They're never going to retract their basic science. Come on. This is a war. They're never going to go away. We have to go away. Meaning we walk away from their fake knowledge, and we continue the battle, and we win hearts and minds. That's what we do. So there you see many of the parallels between COVID and AIDS. There you see the construction. And you can see how the parts interact. You have the test, you get the case numbers. You get the case numbers, you get the lockdowns. You get the case numbers, you get the fear porn. You get the risk groups. You get the fear porn directed at the risk groups, which helps to kill the risk groups. You get the vague listing of symptoms. You get the easier diagnosis. You get the case numbers. The parts mesh. It's a machine. It works together. You have to see the parts, and you have to see how they collaborate. And then you see the full picture. You see the death machine, which is basically what we're talking about. And I'm not even in this particular podcast stressing the death part of the death machine. I mean, I could do 6 hours on that alone. The murder, the mass murder, and the mass murderers. Here, I wanted to give you the construction, the political scientific construction parallels between AIDS and COVID. This was not easy, okay? It was easy when COVID was declared, but it wasn't easy in 87, 88. There was a lot of wading through pools, not knowing exactly what the next thing was. And there were a lot of distractions, and there were a lot of distractors. And I have to say, and I've said it before, that the full method that I came to with AIDS needs to be, all right, that's my opinion, more fully understood and appreciated. And used, that's the point. Forget understood, appreciated. Understood and used. And that is, you look at the targeted groups in any pandemic, and then you see what is actually happening to those people in those groups. What are they suffering from? The obvious things. I mean, what's happening to them? And then you explore and you find out what's really causing the suffering and the death in those groups. Not the one thing, all of the thing, the major things. And when you do that, you discover you've got enough to explain what's causing the suffering and the death of the people in those groups, and you don't need the virus. The virus is irrelevant. That's the method that gets you there. And I've seen people use pieces of it and parts of it, but it should be used broadly and widely and completely. Now, there's one other thing that I have to say before I close here, and this, of course, also could be a complete podcast in and of itself, and that is the use of the virus as a cover story. And when I say cover story, I mean in a kind of intelligence agency type covert operation cover story. And that was also part of what I discovered with AIDS, and it works with COVID too. And that is the use of the virus narrative, the story of the virus, to hide and conceal crimes, ongoing crimes, and to promote current and future crimes. And this has been somewhat explored, but needs to be completely presented, as I have. I've given the example many times of AIDS in Africa, but I could just as easily have talked about Zika in Brazil. I could have talked about SARS 2003 in Toronto. The virus is the greatest cover story, modern cover story ever invented. When you've got governments and elite foundations and planners behind the scenes and covert ops specialists at the highest levels who want to wreck civilizations and build on the ashes their brave new world, they're committing major crimes to destroy civilization. And in Africa, for example, the maintenance of hunger, starvation, protein, calorie, malnutrition, dehydration, the weakening of populations, the massive pollution caused by corporations that steal the good growing land from the people and establish factories and mining operations and so on and so forth, pumping sewage water directly into the drinking supplies and never putting in really the basics of sanitation and overcrowding populations and all of that in war, et cetera, and extreme poverty. These are crimes aimed at the takeover of the land and the people and the destruction of whatever kind of civilization the people have built on their own historically. Now, you need cover stories when you launch 200, 100-year covert ops like that. And one of the biggest cover stories employed in Africa, perhaps the biggest, was HIV. No, you see, all of that destruction that we're seeing in people all over here and there in this country, and that, it's all HIV. That's what it is. It's HIV. That's what's doing it. Yeah. People fall for it. That's the other vector here, you see. Now you're talking about why are we promoting all of this fakery? What's behind it all? Well, that's what's behind it all. It's a cover story. That has not been explored nearly enough and exposed. And I've been talking about it and exploring it and exposing it and nonstop since 1988. That alone would give you great pause for thought. Oh, you mean when they say it's the virus that's doing all of that, it's covering up all of these other, yeah, I see, it's covering up all, yeah. Wow, wow. So you're saying that the other crimes are really what's causing all the people to die, and the virus is just the cover. So that means the virus isn't really doing it, and actually, the virus doesn't exist at all. Yeah. Now you're putting it together in an even bigger form. And I should have said that's part of the construction too. Ellis Medavoy certainly meant that in the many interviews that I had with him that are in The Matrix Revealed. He's talking about covert ops and cover stories all the time in a way. In many ways, this is what intelligence agency type operations do, and they reflect the kind of covert ops that are carried on at even higher levels. Same pattern. We need what the covert op is, which is to destroy, therefore we control what we destroyed, and we rebuild what we want to rebuild on it, and then we control everything in that territory and all the people. Yeah. That's the covert op itself, however we do that. And then we need a cover story to conceal that, And then we need to posit various false trails that will lead some people down, you know, oh, that looks important. Oh, yeah, that could be. And we get to the end of it, blind alley at midnight, nowhere to go. You know, spent all that time, didn't get there, didn't get anywhere. False trails, cover story, covert op. And we need, of course, propagandists convincing to promote the cover story. You know, all of that. That's big. That's big. That gives you the And I've tried to interest people in that. I'm talking about reporters over the years. And have succeeded to a degree, but not to the degree that it should have succeeded. Because there are many people who, when they see that piece, their brain lights up all over the place. And flashing signs come on and alarm bells go off and they get it. They get it. And that's why the medical is so important for political reporters who are real political reporters. You just can't do the deepest kind of political reporting without the medical. It just doesn't work. It runs into contradictions and blind alleys and shortened narratives. And that's something that I've try to impress on reporters as well. And just everybody. Look, if you're going to do research on deep politics, you got to do research on deep medical. You just have to. It's no accident that the Rockefeller Empire, which is one of the preeminent elite organizations on the planet, has specialized in medical research and medical control for more than 100 years, as well as international political control through Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission and numerous other forums and mentorships and so on and so forth. Relations with China. It's all part of a whole. It's one piece. And AIDS was what I would call the first truly modern attempt to sow universal fear in the population through extensive propaganda, using every tool of modern propaganda, with a virus story. Yes, there was the story of the 1918 flu and all of that, but modern propaganda had, you know, just not advanced to the point where it had the kind of technological reach that it had in the 1980s. We are the medical people. We know what is going on in the population. We will tell you. We will tell you what your reaction should be. We will tell you much what you must do. We will tell you what you are at risk for. We will tell you what to be afraid of. We will tell you what test to take. We will tell you what treatment to take. That's political control. And you see how much more successful, with lessons learned, COVID was than with AIDS in terms of universality. Okay. I may do another one, like, you know, as a continuation of this, but I've given you a lot here, an awful lot, and some flavor of what it took to build the construction and then see it and then apply it in the new venue in 2020 from 1980s. Thank you. This is John Rappaport.